think that's Alice in Wonderland. I don't know. That's Pogo. Pogomusic.net. I don't want to talk over this, so I'm just going to turn it down a little bit more. Pogomusic.net. He's got some really cool tunes out there. It's very chill. He just takes movies, a lot of Disney, remixes them, and comes up with these transient, is that the word I'm looking for? Hypnotic tunes. And they're very relaxing, and I enjoy listening to them. And I hope you enjoy listening to them, too. It's been a while since I've been on this podcast in just such a normal setting. I'm going to turn this down because it's distracting me. It's been a while since I've been on with just a one-on-one interview. This is what I love to do. I enjoy doing the live podcast and all that stuff. We have a lot of fun with those, but I want to get back into interviewing people. And of course, I have a cold. That's par for the course right now. I don't know what's going on with my immune system, but every single freaking virus out there I am catching, and it's driving me crazy. This is the worst year for it yet, and I don't know if it has something to do with the fact that, you know, this is what I do for a living, and people are just bringing their viruses into my clinic, or my kids started, both kids started preschool this year, and they're bringing home everything. I don't know, one or the other, because I'm healthy. I feel like I'm healthy. Not as healthy as I could be, which we will talk about next. That's a little segue there. Let's just get into it. Tonight I have Jason Seib, Jason S-E-I-B. He is the creator of Alt Shift Diet. He is the author of The Paleo Coach, co-host of the popular Alt Shift podcast, founder and co-owner of Alt Shift Fitness and Fat Loss. And I guess that's a gym over in Portland, Oregon. So if you're listening from Portland, Oregon, go check it out. I don't want to get too ahead of myself because we're going to be chatting with him here in a minute. But we're always, as a society, we seem to jump on the latest gimmick, you know, whatever it may be, for health and fitness. I have patients come in all the time, and they're telling me that they're taking this supplement or that supplement or this medication or that medication. And my biggest fear is sustainability. They can't sustain it. And their body will actually adapt and shut down its... Well, there's a host of things which will make people fail. Once they fail, it's hard to get back on a healthy path because you feel powerless. And in a way, we are powerless. This is a relatively new problem. Obesity, diabetes, metabolic syndrome, those are all a new thing over the past 50 or 60 years. I mean, they've been around, but not to the extent that we see them. So we have to think outside the box on how to deal with these things. And there's a lot of programs out there to think outside the box. One of the more popular ones, and the one that makes most sense to me as a provider and as a practitioner, I guess, is paleo, ancestral, and intermittent fasting. Basically, how we look at it is our bodies have had 200,000 years of evolution to perfect survival. And then we come along over the 75 years or whatever since we started eating processed foods, all these diseases come in, and then we think we can just alter, or we can continue with what we've been doing for 75 years, but alter that somehow, instead of just looking back to the way we've survived for so long. And I don't know. I don't want to get, like I said, get too into it. So with that said, we're going to bring on Jason, and he is going to school us on everything paleo and sustainable fat loss and fitness and health and all that good stuff.
You're listening to the Weight What If podcast.
I guess we could just start. I'll tell you kind of the backstory for the listeners of what's going on is everyone who listens to the show knows I'm a medical practitioner, and I was hired on to kind of patch people up so they can go back to work. So my job is, you know, you sprain your ankle, you bust a toe, you come and see me, I patch you up and get you back to work, you know, so you're not taking too much time off and you don't have to spend gazillions of dollars in an emergency room. They get me at a flat rate as a PA. I have one assistant, and we get all our medical supplies really cheap. So it's just a win-win. I have a great job. I have a lot of autonomy, which a lot of PAs don't have. And the county I work for saves a ton of money because they don't get the charge up that you would see in, you know, at a urgent care or an emergency room. Well, as a practitioner, a lot of my patients come in and I see the same thing over and over. In fact, I'm shocked when a patient comes in and I see normal blood pressure, normal weight, and no medications. That's a rarity for me. And I start crunching numbers, and it dawned on me, if my job is to come into this county and save the money and treat these people, why am I avoiding the elephant in the room, so to speak? So I've been trying to implement, I had mentioned Rob Wolf. I'd heard what he did with the Reno Fire Department. So I honestly have no idea where to start. So I just started reaching out to people, and I found your book, and I read it. I'm a big reader, and I think you have a lot of good information in there. I'm going to put a link on my site. We'll talk about where people can get that. But so where did you begin? When did this become a? I guess it seems like it's your life's calling.
So I came to all of this I started working out on my own when I was about 20 years old, maybe 19, almost 20. I'm 43 now. The guy who taught me how to work out was a enormous bodybuilder, 5'11", 257 pounds with a 30-inch waist, 22-inch arms, 90%, lots and lots of titles.
90% Neanderthal, it sounds like.
Yeah, right. Yeah, just enormous, really great guy. Took me under his wing, taught me how to do the basics, and I kind of went the route of the geek instead of the gym rat, and really got interested in the research. And that was back when you had to go to the library and look at microfiche to find the studies. You couldn't just get on the internet, and I just geeked out, started trying to help some other people, eventually ended up wanting to become a trainer, did that kind of on the side for a long time, and then realized that, you know, I could probably do this as my primary source of income, something like 15 years ago, I guess, and got into that, realized very quickly that, you know, when people wanted to come work out, they were trying to do that from the perspective of, I'm going to do exercise now because I did diet last time. And then they, you know, you try to get them to eat right too, and they oftentimes don't want to do that. And then I ended up opening my own gym eventually so I could have a little bit more control, and started, you know, had a small gym. I actually was doing work that was excited about doing, but still, you know, people were you know, quitting left and right because that's what human nature drives them to do. And I eventually created AltShift, which I think we're going to talk mostly about today. And after, you know, coming out of the sort of the paleo world, and, you know, I have another book, The Paleo Coach, which is very well reviewed, but not read too often anymore on Amazon. But I came out of that world and was doing a lot of blogging and some talks around the country with Sarah Fragoso of Everyday Paleo. And when I created AltShift, it was a culmination of all of this experience and a lot of experimenting over a lot of years with a lot of different clients and myself and my wife, and created some really amazing results in my wife, Cheryl, who's in the book. And then that eventually led me to, along the way, I had been working with a gentleman named Robert Beeswastiner, who is a very prominent, successful psychologist with a really great career in positive psychology and coaching. And I had been working with him, just sitting down and brainstorming with him on a regular basis. And after the creation of AltShift, came to that place where I was like, okay, look, we have created something that absolutely works every time people do it. It works to some degree. Obviously, there's genetics and history and metabolic damage and all that kind of stuff that can play into it all. But it absolutely works in virtually everybody who does it, and people do it. They get great results. They post amazing pictures, and then they quit. And then they come back to me later going, I don't know why I quit. Why did I quit? I was getting such amazing results. I can't get back on the wagon now. What's going on here? Why is this yo-yo dieting thing happening to me again? And out of that came Body Beliefs. And that is the book that has put me in front of the most people. And that one is aimed at women, and it's about why people fail even when the system that they're using works like a miracle.
Right.
Why a huge amount still fail.
And the paleo brings
us up to the present.
Yeah. Well, the paleo, and I think I mentioned this during our email conversations, the paleo approach to things tends to be considered outside the norm, which I think is fascinating. I'm formally trained in Western medicine, grad school, I had to do rounds, and it had never been taught to me. I had never heard of it until, I started dealing with patients and I started seeing the different failures with patients and the different diseases associated with standard American diet. And it wasn't only, I want to say maybe last 4 years, I started reading and researching and implementing it myself. Why do you think the disconnect, if you have an opinion, the disconnect between Western medicine and this sort of ancestral lifestyle push?
Well, I don't even know if it's a disconnect as much as it's just two separate subjects. I mean, there's Western medicine is not about health. It's about not sick.
Right.
And you as a doctor, you are expected to treat diseases and symptoms and disorders and things like that, but you're not producing health in the terms of vitality. You're producing the absence of sickness. And so, when you went to school, you didn't really get, I haven't asked you this ahead of time, but I can confidently say you didn't really get to spend any real time on nutrition when you went to school.
Oh, absolutely.
Because to mention that in a room of doctors, say talking about some sort of disorders, to say something like, well, let's start with what this person's eating and figure out what's caused it. It'll be a bunch of eye rolling in most cases. I mean, I'm not to say that there's not, a lot of great doctors out there. I'm just saying that that's not what's taught at the academic level. That as soon as you start mentioning nutrition, you are now looked at like you're getting into, holistic, naturopathy or something, like you're no longer talking about modern medicine. And so I think the disconnect comes from the fact that, I've made this joke. I used to say that in my gym, I used to my waiver had to say, before you start an exercise or nutrition program, you need to talk to your doctor. And I always used to make the joke that said, you need to talk to your doctor, your hairstylist, and your mechanic, because all three of those people likely have roughly the similar educations when it comes to nutrition and especially exercise. Doctor, your average general practitioner has no exercise science. And, I just think they're different subjects. Like the medical community isn't doing anything wrong. They're not evil. It's aimed at the treatment of disease, not the producing health and vitality. And those are very separate things. And then secondly, it's economics. It's not, people think that, when we say we want our kids to grow up to be doctors and lawyers, we are talking about wanting them to grow up to be successful. We're not talking about wanting them to grow up to be saints.
Right.
And if you are a doctor, you get up and put your pants on and go to work every day. And so does that pharmaceutical rep that comes in your door and trying to sell you drugs and telling you about the research that you don't have time to read. And, the insurance companies that want to pay you less and less. So you're spending less and less time with each patient. And the more time you spend, the less likely you are to make as much money as you made last year. And, these are unrelated problems to why doesn't the world pay attention to the fact that, humans are animals. We're probably going to have to admit that. And then we're going to have to look at the fact that when an animal is adapted to its environment, that environment accidentally produces healthy animals.
Right.
And we are unhealthy. So there is a problem. And what are we supposed to be adapted to? And you start looking at those things and health comes out of that.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it's a different definition of health than what paleo is producing, and alt shift by extension is producing, is a health in that means you don't go to your doctor as far as your doctor is concerned. It's taking you to a baseline, but then it takes you far beyond that and your doctor doesn't care about that because they don't see you. You right. see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So like if you go from not sick to extremely healthy, the whole distance between that will be unmeasured by your doctor because right. they have no way to measure that.
Right.
You're simply not in the blood ranges, you know, like, you know, we do blood tests and look at hormones and lipids and all those things. You're just simply not in the ranges that are problematic. We don't have a way to measure the fact that, hey, this person looks like a freaking superhero compared to everybody else their age. There's no real way to measure that. Those yeah. are just all things that you can observe with your eyes and kind of jump to conclusions, but you can't put a number on it. You can't say the average person is a health level 5 and this person's at a health level 15, but 5 is the baseline with no disease. There's no way to do that because that doesn't make money.
Right. No, you're absolutely right. Have you ever seen the documentary Blackfish about the, I think it was that Blackfish. It was about the killer whale. And the killer whales in captivity, their musculature changes. I think it's their dorsal fin will get floppy. It flops over. And scientists mm-hmm. can't figure out why. They're like, why the hell is this happening? We can't figure out why these things. It's because take an animal out of its element and place it into a controlled environment, you'll weaken and you'll weaken tremendously and you'll, you know, get sick as a result of it. And it just makes sense. It's just without having looked at it through my PA school, which is like a mini med school, we never, ever looked back on it. We did a little bit of evolution, I guess, I don't know, the prerequisite courses or something. I don't remember. I honestly don't remember taking anything like that. But it only makes sense. We've had 75 years of this modern diet since World War II, and that's really when it changed. I mean, I guess you could say during the Industrial Revolution, but 75 years compared to 200,000 years of human evolution is it's not even a drop in the bucket. It's such a small amount. I don't know what the percentage is. Maybe you could come up with it, 0.001% or something like that. It's such a small.
It's way beyond that. Yeah, yeah, it's like a blink. But I mean, the interesting thing is that this stuff is not even remotely a mystery when we talk about animals.
Right.
We could take somebody who has never been to a zoo before, and we could say to that person, "Hey, we've got a tiger coming in today. We took it out of the jungle. We're going to put it in this cage, and dramatically limit its ability to move around. It's not going to have any other tigers around. We're going to feed it 40% of its natural diet and keep it stressed out most of the time
yeah.
about things that really don't have anything to do with its survival, but it's going to stress out. What do you think our outcomes are going to be here? Do you think we're going to produce a healthy tiger?" And that person that maybe heard the word tiger for the first time that day is going to go, "No, you're crazy."
Right.
But with humans, when we're talking about ourselves, we just have blinders on. And part of that is just because people just do not want to admit that we're animals.
Exactly. I was just going to say that. I was just going to say that. Yeah, we fail to recognize the human animal.
God forbid we recognize ourselves as, you know, a pretty cool, well, pretty self-righteous, pretty cool species of ape. Mm-hmm. And if we look at ourselves in that context, we come up with some really awesome answers very, very quickly.
Sure. Something I want to touch on, which you had said there's little to no education in exercise physiology for doctors. And again, I can only speak for PAs, but you know, PA school was in a med school when we did it. There was none of that. There are some doctors, however, that have, you know, brought a lot of this up. Are you familiar with Dr. McGuff? Doug McGuff, Body by Science, I think his book is called.
Yeah, he's the super slow guy.
Yeah, yeah, super slow and adaptation yeah. and all that. But when you look at it, I was guilty of the same thing, you know, telling my patients, okay, you're gaining weight. Let's eat less. Let's move more. Get in the gym. I want you to start doing this. Start looking at the calories. I want you to, you know, your baseline is 2,300 calories. Let's try to cut 300 calories. This is the advice I was giving people for many years. And to little to no success. I don't know what the number is of people who lose weight and gain it back, but I want to say it's in the 90s.
Probably more than that.
Yeah, and over
it's probably higher than that.
And over a decade, it's got to be close to 100%. I mean, if you're talking gain any weight back, it's got to be 100%. But to gain a significant
even if you're talking about all the yeah even if you're talking about gaining all the weight back, I guarantee you it's over 90%. Weight Watchers has a 95% failure rate at the 1-year mark, And so I believe 95% of those people are heavier at the 5-year mark. Mm-hmm. And obviously Weight Watchers is a caloric restriction program that, you know, they've been trying to do some better things over the recent years, but it's a program that vilifies food in general.
Exactly.
And says that if you just eat less food, you'll weigh less. And that's a ridiculous approach to weight loss. But like I said, I mean, I have working on 4 years of research now, all on the psychology side, because I mean, I created a program that absolutely does work in people, and I can sell that book. I can have people get results and post their before and after pictures and be 4 or 5 generations into their friends before they finally fail and quit. Mm-hmm. But the fact is they're failing and quitting, and I know it's not my protocol, and they're telling me that it's not my protocol. They're telling me that I don't know why I quit. It felt easy. I felt great. But I quit anyway. And then when we dig into that, well, I was able to produce a whole book on that. But that failure rate is driven by, yeah, I mean, we operate under the same rules as most mammals. And when it comes to food, it's optimum foraging strategy. And what that says is you go out in the world, you find the easiest calories to get. You don't go, you know, if you've got calories right here in front of you 10 steps away, you don't walk 100 steps to get other calories. Now, there's some stuff that blurs that line a little bit because we're omnivores. Mm-hmm. We get things like palate fatigue that causes us to go out and seek a bit of variety. But nonetheless, for the most part, we can say that we stick to that rule. And then once we have food, we are supposed to sit down. And then you play in palatability to the equation where, you know, in nature, if something tastes really good, it is really good for you. That's mm-hmm. why you evolved taste buds. And you evolved dopamine because dopamine is a wanting hormone, not a liking hormone. It makes you repeat things. You found something that is really good for you. Your taste buds have proven that. We know that it's really good for you because it tastes good. And now dopamine hits you and says, do that again. Well, in our modern environment, we have altered this system to the point where we have foods like, say, cheesecake that has pretty much no nutritional value, but very high palatability taken from other things and added to this food. So every cell in your body outside of your tiny little prefrontal cortex in the front of your brain, when you're looking down the barrel of a cheesecake, is saying the right answer is to eat as much of this as you can, look around and see if there's more that you can eat. And then when you're done, you need to sit down and rest and not waste energy because you're going to need that to find more food later.
Right.
And so we have been able to make hyperpalatable foods that are bad for us and outsource most of our movement. And people gain weight back because they're fighting against animal drives. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, those deep-seated like reptilian level brain drives. But then on top of that, almost everybody's extrinsically motivated. They're doing it because they think if they look better, that the world will treat them different and they will somehow have some sort of benefit that they've never thought through. If you ask people, well, you know, why, especially women, why do you want to lose weight? You hear things like they stutter. Like, everybody wants to lose weight. Well, no, why? Well, I'd be more confident. Okay, so you just spent your whole adult life and all this anxiety beating the snot out of yourself in the mirror because if you lose weight, you'll be nicer to you?
Yeah.
Why not just be nicer to you? Why not stop saying when you walk into rooms full of new people, stop saying things like, all these people think I'm fat because I think I'm fat. I just wish I wasn't here. Why not stop saying things to yourself in the mirror like, I can't wear this outfit because it makes me look gross. You can stop doing all of that because, you know, pushing yourself down that psychotic road of needing to change your body, hoping something besides some people walking by you and telling you that you lost weight will happen is madness. And you virtually never actually get to the weight loss because you've got 1,000 reasons every day to stop. Yes, failure is the norm.
When you really think about it, if you asked everybody out on the street, do you think you could improve yourself physically? I would venture a guess 80 to 90% would say yes. I mean, just for the fact that 80%, almost 80%, at least in my county, almost 80% of people are either overweight or obese.
2% of women in the Western world describe themselves as beautiful.
Wow.
98% do not. So yes, 98% would tell you that they could improve themselves. But see, this goes way beyond just... See, they're just, first off, they're distilling everything down to physical attraction.
Okay.
And that's ridiculous. Are you married?
Yeah. Yeah, and I have a little daughter, which so it breaks my heart to you know think about the level of internal dialogue she's going to have with herself.
Yeah. Well, you can fix all of that. I'm fixing it with my three girls. But the thing is that you did not marry a body.
Right.
Believe it or not, you married a woman. And to distill that down to the only reason that she attracted you was because of her body is just ridiculous.
That's right.
And so, I mean, but, you know, a moment ago you said people wanting to better themselves, how much effort they put into bettering themselves. And the only thing they're looking at is that physical aspect without looking at attraction as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't marry, you know, round butts. You marry somebody that you want to sit up at night with and talk to. Somebody will be your confidant, somebody that you can ask for advice and confide in, and somebody who makes you feel good when you're around them, and they're funny and intelligent and all of these characteristics. And not, I've never heard of one woman ever standing in front of a mirror going, "You're not funny enough. You're not smart enough."
Right.
And they beat the snot out of themselves over all of the wrong stuff. And so it ends up being this situation. And I don't know if we're going down a path here where you intended to go down, but it ends up being the situation where, you know, it's like, you know, say you got up every morning and you looked at your daughter and you said, "You disgust me. Every time I look at you, I think that you are just doing horrible things. It's just awful where you've let yourself get to. When we're around other kids, I think about how you can probably never be as good as them. There's maybe not even any point in you trying, but I guess maybe we might as well try to make some good decisions today. Let's go do that, shall we?" That's how 98% of women typically on some level are coaching themselves to try to create beauty. And that's asinine.
Right.
It's asinine and heartbreaking that you could think that you can take a attitude that says, "Oh, you look gross today. Oh, your skin's washed out. Oh, I need to take five selfies because those other four looked awful." Oh, all these things you would never say to a friend. Look at a friend one time, look at a friend and go, "You need to change that shirt. It makes you look fat." I dare you to say that to a friend just one time. You would never, but typically saying these things, women are typically saying these things to themselves every single day. And they're pretending that that's a good way to coach themselves to something amazing that they will love being.
Right.
And that's just not going to happen. And we can't let our daughters go down that road.
Where does it come from? Is it a combination of society? Is it where does that come from, that internal dialogue?
Well, it comes from the fact that modern society is not supposed to look like this. And when I say that, I don't mean like marketing and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I hear that a lot. But the media tells us that we have to look this way. Okay, I can understand that, but you've never dated the media. Not one time did the media knock on your door and ask you out for a blind date.
Mm-hmm.
You look around in your world and you see actual real couples. And you see couples all the time that you go, both of those people are super attractive. Both of those people are maybe not as attractive, and tons of them that are really mismatched. So to look at the TV and say that every woman has to look like Jennifer Aniston is to ignore the real world. To just put the blinders on and completely ignore the real world. But where society does really mess up women, more so than men, comes from, well, let's start with something I talked about in body beliefs. My friend Robert, the psychologist, spent some time with the Maasai in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And they are a herding culture now, but they typically live very close to the lifestyle that hunter-gatherers would live. They're separated from society and very tribal.
They are.
They went around to all of them.
They're badass warriors too. They're badass warriors too.
Yeah.
Having studied lots of martial arts, the Maasai are, they got some, I digress. Go ahead.
Yeah. So they went to a bunch of these people, men and women, and said, "Are you attractive?" And they were all like, "Yeah, duh." And they go, "Well, why do you think that?" And these people would point at they go, "Well, you know, my jewelry or my blanket or my clothes." They have no idea what they look like. They have no concept of what they look like other than what they can look down on. There's no such thing as a full-length mirror. There's no such thing as a scale or a measuring tape that tells a person what their waist should be. They don't have pants that don't fit you because you're not as good as that person over there. And when you went to this one place to get all of these pants, all the cool people were buying those and you don't fit in, so you're a loser. There's also no such thing as strangers. There's no way for you to go walking. I mean, there is to the degree that people show up and see these people now. But for 2.6 million years that our species was under development, there was your tribe, an outlying tribe or two, maybe a few that you saw once in a while. You virtually knew who everybody was. If you were a single female, not pregnant or carrying a child or nursing a child at the moment, in other words, you were acceptable breeding stock in your area, you probably had competition that amounted to two or three or four other women. And you couldn't go to the mall and walk past women and go, I know exactly what I look like and I don't look like her. She is prettier than me, therefore she's better than me. And that's happening rapid fire in women's minds, even though that woman over there could have just punched a kid. She could be a freaking serial killer. You know nothing about her. And women will do this rapid fire social comparison, and they especially focus in on things that they are insecure about themselves. Like if you think you have good legs, you hardly notice anybody's legs. But if you think you have fat legs, then legs is what you look at. And it's just very quickly ranking yourself among them, but it's only happening via looks. And that's because inherently typically human women in the traditional roles put on a display, and then they do the choosing in sexual selection. They need enough males to come, you know, flaunt themselves like banty roosters and to choose from so that they can choose the best possible genetics to mate with to push their offspring downstream in a strong fashion. So all of this worked really, really well until modern times. But to take it a step worse and make it where in the last 10 years things have really fallen apart, we see situations where, you know, there's a study showing that 2-week old infants are already analyzing faces in the way that male infants are not.
That's right.
2-week old female infants. And they're already developing emotional intelligence, and they develop social bonds to the degree that when women hit puberty, they rank themselves by their popularity, literally by how many people like them. Whereas boys are throwing elbows. So their rank is literally how close to the top of the heap they are. They're playing sports. They're talking trash. Sometimes they're even fighting.
Right.
But girls get accused of being catty because they're very carefully talking trash so that they don't accidentally lose a number on the list of how many people like them. So you take this situation, and we can see this all the way into like rhesus macaques. They're, you know, primates that bond together like this, the fair of the species, protecting each other and helping each other out. And so you take this situation and you throw social media into the mix and you break women. 1 in 4 teenage girls, I just saw a statistic the other day, 1 in 4 teenage girls is clinically depressed right now. 1 in 3 girls at 14 has shown signs of clinical depression in the last 6 months.
Wow.
The only major thing that has changed is social media. When women are interviewed to find out what social media how it plays into their life, they say it's necessary. They say it's something that they feel like they don't want to miss out on. They say it's a way to communicate, a way to see how many people like them, a way to find out how they rank, all of those types of things. But they do not say they like it. Men see it as entertainment. If you take a man who's active on social media and tell him he can't be on social media for a month, he'll see it like you took away his favorite Netflix show.
Yeah,
but women see it as absolutely necessary. Now they've got a number of total friends. They've got a number of likes on their last picture. They've got the addiction factors that these social media companies are playing in where, you know, Instagram not that long ago, and I'm positive Facebook too, they release likes in batches. They withhold them and then release them in batches to do that random reward thing that you get from slot machines to literally make it more addictive. All the people that used to go to work for casinos are now going to work for social media companies, and they're doing this to hook these women in. And now in mere seconds, women can get blasted with the highlight reels of everybody's lives to the degree that they are constantly being shown how bad their real life sucks in comparison to the fake lives of everybody else.
Well, you say something important.
And then. You
say highlight reels, and that's
what's that?
I said, you said something important there, and that's,
oh, yeah.
That's highlight reels. I used to like baseball. I can't stand it now, but I'll watch the highlights because the game itself is boring. It's all get out. But the highlight, right. The highlight is the exciting part. That's all you're seeing on social media.
Well, yeah.
You're seeing and I wouldn't even call it the best. It's the best that they can put forward, you know, the angles, the
right.
How they can make any trivial event seem like it's an amazing event that you need to strive for.
Right. So you get a situation where, you know, a person is only showing you what they want you to see, but you're doing it too. Like if you're that person that took 5 or 20 selfies before you finally found one that you posted, you completely forget that everybody else is doing that too.
That's right.
You convince yourself that the rest of the world is just showing you their honest lives and you're having to doctor your life to even moderately keep up to how amazing theirs are. I mean, just scroll through your social media feed and you will see the same basic angles on the same people taking the same photos because they know what angle they need to be photographed in. They know, you know, it's all a huge game and it plays into women's innate social drives exactly like cocaine plays into happiness.
And it alters it too.
It's not real.
It's because totally. I was trying to take, and I'm exactly the guy that you're talking about. I'm 40 years old. I could care less about social media. I mean, I use it to market my brand, but beyond that, I remember when the election was going on last year, it was entertaining, so I was on it a lot. But mm-hmm. after that, I could care less. So I'm sitting with my daughter, and I go to take a picture, and it took me 5 minutes to figure out how to flip the camera around to sit to do selfie. But I flip it around, and my face looked funny. I was looking at it like, what is going on here? And then I started messing with the settings, and it was airbrushing me in real time. So I was seeing me without freckles.
Wow.
And I was like, what the hell is going on here? But that's the first connection I've ever made to it until you just said that there. So even these pictures that people are putting up aren't even real pictures.
No, yeah, it's all really, really a mess. And I don't know if your intention was for us to go down this rabbit hole on this podcast, but I mean,
well,
this is the realm that I work in now, is trying to answer those questions of, you know, people don't quit dieting and fail because of protocols. They don't. I mean, unless a protocol is unhealthy and over time it starts to make them feel really bad.
Right.
But the guidelines of Alt Shift, I've never once heard that. I've never once heard somebody say, I got results and then I just quit because of the guidelines. They do things like, you know, you get stressed out. If you're stressed out and you're extrinsically motivated, you're not doing any of this for you anyway.
Right.
You're doing it because you think everybody else will love you better. What is stress? If stress is anything, it's a time when life is forcing you to be selfish. And since you were trying to lose weight out of spite because those freaking jerks won't just love you the way you are, you tell all those jerks to go to hell when stress hits you. You know, and then you got situations like, well, I deserve a treat. Well, if you were intrinsically motivated to doing this for you, I deserve a treat sounds a lot like saying, you know, I did such a good job cleaning my house, I deserve to throw a big handful of dirt on my living room floor.
Right.
That doesn't make any sense until you're extrinsically motivated, until mm-hmm. you're doing this for unexamined reasons. So the first thing you need to know is, why do you want to lose weight? And usually it's, well, I'll be more confident. Nope. See, if you go to the bookstore, there are whole sections of books on confidence. Not one of them says the way to get confident is get into a size 6 jeans. If you're in a size 6 jeans, you will be confident. Not one of them. If you really wanted confidence, you would be working on confidence. What you really want is to not be so mean to you. You really want to not wake up in the morning, look in the mirror, and be disappointed while you pinch things and tell yourself that you suck. That's what you're hoping will happen. But in the real world, nothing's happening. If you do lose the weight, you don't get a raise. If you don't lose the weight, they don't take your kids away. You know, nothing really happens to you unless there's somebody in your life that's constantly telling you that you suck because you're overweight, in which case you don't have a body problem. You have a filter problem.
Right.
You let somebody who sucks into your life.
Or it's yourself. So, like you said, you're telling yourself that. And then
if you want to get a body that looks awesome, you've got to get really healthy, and you can't get really healthy unless you're intrinsically motivated. You just can't. I never see it happen. So you have to examine those motivations. You got to sit down and meditate. You got to get some mindfulness into your life and start asking all the right questions as you're about to do the things that trip you up. When you're telling yourself things like, oh, one bite won't hurt. Well, okay, well, why will one bite benefit you? What's the value of that treat right there? Did you really just spend all day long saying, I want to lose weight, I want to feel better, I want to look better, I want to not stress out when I go bathing suit shopping, I want all of these things so bad, but right now I'm going to throw all that out the window for yum. Did you really just say that? No, of course you didn't say that if you were honestly thinking about it in the moment. You can only say that through unexamined emotions. So that's where I do most of my work now, because the protocol, which I guess we should probably get to, is in place and has been for a long time, and it works fantastic. So,
I think this is really important because, well, I haven't read Body Beliefs yet. In fact, I actually ordered a half dozen copies for my only because I heard you talk to Rob Wolf about it. When I heard that, I was like, you know, this could benefit some of my people. But you know how it's a government agency. So I ordered them about 2 weeks ago and I'm hoping to get them soon. But yeah, I ordered a half dozen copies to get out to my patients. And now I'm actually even more excited about it because you explained it perfect. You know, I can get people, I can put people on medicine, right? I can give people a shot every single day of their lives that will make them lose, you know, within a few months, 10% of their body fat. And it will fail.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the, I mean, these people are shooting themselves with medicine. It doesn't feel good. They are taking that step and yet they'll still fail. And as a practitioner, it's my job to explore. And I guess it's the medical community in general. It's their job to explore why the failure, because the more failure we have, the more sickness we're going to have, the more disease we're going to have. And we're at a tipping point. And a lot of people don't realize this. We're approaching 50% of individuals with type 2 diabetes. There was a general, a 4-star general, and his name's escaping me right now, but he testified before Congress that this is a national security threat. Why is it a national security threat? We're going to bankrupt ourselves. Plus, we won't have the people to fight. Plus, everyone's going to be sick. So we are at a tipping point. And every day, like I said, when people come in, someone comes in with a broken toe, and I look at them and they're 250 pounds and 42% body fat. I want to say, I address it. I try to address it every time I can. But as a practitioner, it feels like we had a term in the military, pissing up a rope. It just gets you messy and you don't get anywhere, right? You know, I can address it. I can put them on medicine. We can talk about diet. But the failure is going to come. And it fail enough times, and I've seen it. I've seen a lot of broken people that have failed enough times that I don't know. I don't know if they're reachable. I would like it to be, and that's I guess, my tasking for the next 15 years before I retire. But, I mean, it's tricky. And I'm hoping, I mean, just from what you explained, it gives me a glimpse of hope. So let's take that. Let's take that person. So you have the person that has dieted. You know, let's say she's a 40-year-old female. Okay, 40 is an important age because they're approaching that premenopausal area. It can happen anywhere between 40 and 50, so they're approaching that area. Weight is going to be much more difficult to take off. Let's say she's obese. Her BMI is 32. All right, she has tried weight loss a number of times, and that's not even, I'm not making that patient up. You know, you know that patient who comes in with the BMI of 32, 33, who's 40 years old with three kids, has tried to lose weight at least, I'm going to guess, 4 or 5 times, maybe more.
Probably more. You're describing 70% of the women I work with.
Right. So what's your first step? How do you say, hey, you know, I understand that you have been defeated so many times and that you've probably given up. Maybe you have, maybe you haven't. But this time, let's work on it. Where's the first place you start?
Well, I'm very, very bad, as all of us will be, at creating reasons for people to do this. And usually, I am not in front of somebody in the same situation you are, where they do not want to diet or they're not thinking about diet, and I'm trying to convince them. Usually somebody's coming to me because they're at least looking at one last ditch effort.
Okay.
But to try to start from where you're at, you know, I would try to convince them that I would say, look, I know that you have had multiple situations in your life that you would call failures, but let's look at this from a completely different tact. What if we're not even going to try to lose weight at all? What if we're going to let weight loss happen by accident? And all we're going to try to do is get you really healthy. And then what if we start from a place where we understand that health is a skill, not a destination? So the way that you've dieted in the past, I'm sure of it, is that you have done something that you would never, ever do when you learned any other skill. And again, an example I gave on Rob Wolf's podcast, if we were to say that this same person wanted to learn the skill of playing the violin, that person would never, she would never pick up the violin, start drawing the bow across the strings a few times, eventually hit a sour note, slam that violin into the case, throw it up on the shelf in the closet, get mad, tell herself what a loser she is and how everybody else is better at playing the violin than she is, and get mad for, you know, 2 or 3 weeks before guilt kicks in and she finally goes, God, I should try the violin again. I just really want to be a virtuoso violin player. I guess I'll try to get and see how far I can get. And then with every mistake, she falls apart. That is not how we learn anything.
Right.
We learn things by making mistakes, trying to figure out how to not make those mistakes again, and keep moving. You didn't walk into math class and know math at whatever level you do now because you went from that first day to now without ever making a mistake. And that's the only reason that you know math, because if you would have made a mistake, you would have had to have quit and then go find some other guru or other method to learn math. That's not how any of that works. You simply sit down and focus and then practice. And you practice and you do it because you're intrinsically motivated to do this. You want to know how to play the violin, not, I don't want to learn how to play the violin, but I want to be the greatest violin player in the world. That is not what happens. And that's what happens with everybody for diet, with dieting. Everybody is coming in and going, I'm going to do this like it's some sort of challenge. I'm going to hate every minute of it. So if I screw up, I'm going to go, well, I blew it. You know, because I ate a Snickers bar, I already blew it. I'll just start again Monday, and now I can get in all the things I love. I can have some ice cream and some pancakes for breakfast tomorrow, and I'll have pizza and beer for dinner tonight, and I'll get all of that out of the way. That stuff, I'm going to get it out of the way. I'll do it now because I love doing it, and then I'll go back to that awful diet so that I can finally change my body so that everybody will like me. No, when this becomes about health, your job isn't to see how long you can go without eating chocolate cake. Your job is to see if you can go the rest of your life having chocolate cake the fewest amount of times. It has nothing to do with how long you go in between. It's just every piece of chocolate cake counts against you. If you're intrinsically motivated, every time you sit down to a healthy meal, you can go, I deserve this meal. I'm getting healthy because I deserve it. And this meal will nourish me and make me feel good. It is completely unrelated to the last meal I had or the next meal I had. You're intrinsically motivated, for example, to shower. You don't shower on a Monday morning because you showered on Sunday and because you know you're going to shower on Tuesday. You shower because every shower is a one-off event, and sometimes you skip, but overall, you do it because you deserve it and you treat yourself well. And it has the added benefit of accidentally making you more attractive by not making you stink. But if we stuck you on a desert island, you would still shower if we gave you a shower. So when we get somebody to change that perspective and we take away their scales, we take away their measuring tapes, we take away their desire to want to look different, or we do our best to do that by asking them why they want that. And we say, don't you just deserve better? Don't you deserve to feel better? What if in 2 or 3 days from now, you could already be feeling better than you do now, and every little step would be a celebration all the way to the grave, not to some goal,
right?
Not to some ridiculous goal that if you haven't got to that goal yet, you're still a failure. You're a failure until you reach it. And then when you finally do reach it, oh, I lost 40 pounds exactly. Now what? Now you go back to the land of being a loser until you hit the next goal? No, every moment, every meal, every walk, every time you prioritize sleep or sit down to meditate to get your head straight so that you can keep doing all this stuff, every one of those is a one-off event that deserves a high five. That's the kind of conversation I would have with that person.
That's fantastic advice. There's a lot of mindfulness in that. Have you ever had formal training in mindfulness or
cognitive behavioral? Just years of research and experimenting.
Wow.
It's a huge portion of what I do now, and I've read, you know, hundreds of papers on it. obviously worked with Robert for an extensive, 4 years now, all looking at all of this. I use mindfulness very cognitively, it's like mindfulness meditation from the standpoint of cognitive behavioral therapy. Mm-hmm. So I don't so much teach people to sit down and try to clear their minds and find a happy place. I teach people to sit down, recognize thoughts, and then learn how to control thoughts. Because when you walk into a room and everybody looks at you and you go, oh, I look gross. I just wish I wasn't here right now because all these people are looking at me. You are making a whole bunch of assumptions that amount to nothing more than self-abuse. Mm-hmm. And that kind of stuff needs to be controlled. What really happened is you walked through a door, some people activated some muscles in their necks and turned and used their eyes to see that there's another human here. Those are the only facts you have. And all of these people have things going on in their heads that you can never know what they are. You need to use mindfulness to change that and go, I don't have any proof. Why am I going to beat myself up? You can think 100 different things. And what if you were one of those people and somebody walked in and said out loud, wow, all these people think I'm fat. Look at them all judging me. Wouldn't you be like, geez, what? Why are you treating me like I'm some kind of jerk? You're really just going to jump to the conclusion that I'm a complete ass based on the fact that you just glanced at me? That's what you're doing to everybody that you do that to. Those thoughts are wrong. They need to be adjusted. That's what cognitive behavioral therapy is. I think it's the most effective therapy for treating depression. I believe it still is. And some of the other emotional disorders. And the idea is you dig into the thinking and go, where is this coming from? What is the thought that this is based on? Like when women go, I desperately need to lose weight. And you ask them why and they stammer.
Yeah.
Because they think that something bigger is going to happen. And really, a couple of people are going to walk by you in the hallway at work and say you look like you lost some weight. That's going to fuel you to go home and take more measurements and do more desperate things as those compliments don't keep coming. And you're doing all of this based on unexamined emotions. There's some thoughts in there that if you just mindfully said, is this really worth all the abuse I put myself through? That I have done this to myself my whole life so some people at work will tell me they think I lost weight once?
Yeah.
Like, really? Is that what this is about? It's just simply unexamined. And, our ancient hunter-gatherer ancestors didn't need mindfulness. They lived in a world that they were very well adapted to, both physically and psychologically. That world doesn't exist anymore. We have to do things that they didn't in order to control base animal instincts that used to work very well, but now are literally killing us.
One thing that changed my life and probably guided me to where I am now as a helper of people, as a medical practitioner, is I was in the Air Force and I was stationed over in Iraq a number of times, and I came back a completely changed person. And I was having some issues, definitely some anger issues, definitely some, I guess you'd call it post-traumatic stress. There's some other ideas about, but we won't get into that. So, and I read a book about, well, through the military at the time, it was becoming a hot button issue. This was probably 2004, 2005, 2006. It was a hot button issue. So they were actively screening anybody. And if you had any sort of signs, you were put right into cognitive behavioral therapy. They gave you a list of books. I mean, I was forced into a lot of research. And I read this. Mm-hmm. I wish I probably still have the book somewhere. I wish I could remember. Maybe it was The Art of Tao. That's going to bug me. I'll tweet it out, whatever it was. But at the beginning, it talks about two ducks on a pond and how they approach mm-hmm. each other. And they get into a kerfuffle. I mean, I don't know whatever ducks argue over, but their feathers ruffle up. They whack each other with their wings, and they fight it off for about 5 seconds, 10 seconds, and then they calm down, and then they go about their business. And if you ever watch ducks do this, which they do every now and then they interact with each other like nothing ever happened. There's no before that moment. There's no after right. that moment. There's only that one moment, and everything before and after means nothing. And then after that moment that occurred, that is now the now moment. And that's why they don't give a shit about each other at this point. It was very, very, very
powerful. Your
dog's
the same way.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Any animal really that doesn't have self-conscious or doesn't have the ability to judge their actions, with what has happened before or what could, that's the other thing. You make up what could happen next. Extremely, extremely powerful. And it actually, I used to be a type A person. I was type A. I was a flyer. I was a combat operator. I was like, you know, I completely opposite than who I am now. And I would say that, you know, we always have like, what do they call it? Red letter dates in your life where things change, you know, where you can count the way things were before that and the way things were after. And it was learning mindfulness and it was learning meditation that actually sent me off in the other direction. Now I can't be more type B in a way. I mean, I guess I'm type B in my attitude, but I'm type A and trying to get things done. But yeah, I can't stress enough at mindfulness, meditation. One of the tricky things as a practitioner, especially a practitioner that experienced it myself, is trying to explain to patients that this is a practical and this is a study, there's data on this, way to go about addressing anxiety, depression, and all those things. It takes time, it takes effort, and that's very, very difficult to...
A lot of hard work.
Oh, gosh. And in a world where people just want that pill to fix things, it's one of the more difficult things to address. And it probably goes along the lines with, you know, weight loss and really anything where you're talking about bettering yourself. Very difficult.
Yeah. I think where mindfulness is, where the rubber really meets the road with the way I teach it, is that you've got to be able to be in those moments, not constantly looking back at them. You know, somebody will tell me something like, I deviated off my diet plan the other day. Well, what happened? Well, I ate some cookies. Okay. No, what happened? Well, what do you mean what happened? I ate some cookies. Like, they're putting cookies on a food log, if you will. And that's not even a fraction of the information that we need. Right. And you can't get the information without mindfulness. The information that we need is, were you having a bad day? Did something lead up to this? Did you think that because your boss was a jerk that cookies were going to make him suddenly not be a jerk for a while in your head at home tonight? Were you, as you were tempted and you reached out your hand, we know you have goals to get healthy and lose weight. So as you reached out your hand, your inner voice had to have been producing some sort of argument that you bought into. What was it? Was it, this one time is okay, I'll get back on track tomorrow, this isn't working anyway, I'm not one of those people who's going to get results, I don't deserve success, I deserve a treat. What, something was going on. And if you don't know what it was, you were not present at all. So when we first start teaching people mindfulness, the hardest part is to learn to be present in those moments. But you don't make these massive changes if you're always looking in your rearview mirror wondering why you blew it. You have to be there for them. You have to be there asking questions. Here's one that your female listeners will be able to relate to. I encounter this on a fairly regular basis. You've got a woman sitting at home on an evening doing nothing, maybe looking at social media, maybe watching TV, whatever. She's been working on getting healthy for a while, and she's feeling some results. So she gets up and she heads to her closet. She's not going anywhere. It's nighttime. She starts trying on clothes, old clothes from the back of the closet. She puts on a particular pair of pants and they fit. They were too tight before. Hooray, this is awesome. So then we go deeper into the closet and find smaller and smaller things. So we go from hooray, this is awesome, to now I'm depressed because I found clothes that don't fit me. And the question that is never asked is, what in the world are you doing? What is the point of this? Even if everything in the closet is, hooray, that's awesome, absolutely everything fits, what do you do now? Do you go to your computer and look at your bank account and suddenly there's $1 million in there? Maybe you go to your husband and he goes, oh my God, all your clothes in your closet fit. I love you so much more now. Maybe your kid makes honor roll. What are you doing? Even if it's all positive, what are you doing in this moment that holds value to you and makes it more likely or less likely or whatever? All of it has to be examined, that you will continue to make good decisions. And chances are, even if it's all positive, you've now given yourself an extrinsic reward. You've said, I am doing this so that these clothes will fit. And then that will become your metric. You're no longer sitting down going, this meal is good for me, I'm going to eat this meal because I deserve it. You're eating this meal to string enough of them together to see if you can get it to even smaller clothes. Nothing kills an extrinsic motivation faster than a paycheck. And you just received one. Just like compliments, it's the same thing. As soon as you start receiving any sort of benefit, some sort of reward that draws you back to the way you look, that will become your focus in a blink. Mm-hmm. And you lose focus on your intrinsic motivations of being all around awesome you hold on to that anxiety that says, I still feel like maybe I'm not attractive. I still need to find out by looking into your eyes and seeing if I've convinced you that I'm attractive so that I can feel like I'm attractive. And everybody can see that on you, and it detracts from your actual attraction, regardless of the shape of your body. So this is the stuff that mindfulness has to be used for. You have to ask yourself these questions in those moments. I'm getting up off the couch to go try on some clothes. Wait, am I going anywhere? Am I really just going to go focus on my body for an hour? What if it's all good? What if it's all bad? What if it's some good and some bad? What, regardless, what is the outcome? What am I expecting to happen right here other than stirring some emotional pot on something that shouldn't be emotional? It should be rote and procedural. I'm going to eat this healthy food because I deserve it. End of discussion. I'm not going to think about this any more than I think about brushing my teeth in the morning. There's better things to think about. Is it really beneficial for me to go spend an hour in my closet at night when I'm not going anywhere? I bet you don't have a female listener who hasn't done that.
I'm gonna ask my wife. Because I know she's got it's something that women do. I have a shirt I don't wear for 6 months. It's gone, right? I just get rid of it. Goodwill, yeah, or something. But I half our closet, we got a walk-in closet. 2/3 of it are clothes that she just doesn't get rid of.
Yeah.
I'm gonna bring that up. Because I just realized I've taken your over an hour of your time right now. One last question I want to throw at you. We talk a lot about women. I would say about 25% of my people that come in that I address weight loss or ask me about weight loss are men. Do you see any challenges that you don't face with women? What's that?
Yes. The men are very easy to intrinsically motivate. They typically are intrinsically motivated when they come in. They want to do this. They don't think that if they're gonna lose a bunch of weight that everybody's gonna love them more. That's right. Not how we're wired. Men can earn dates, you know, just by growing bigger antlers. So men don't feel those same pressures, those same innate pressures to put on a good display that then passively draws over mates. We will go ask women out. We will go do our display right in front of them, go talk to them, go show them that we have a good career. We can take good care of them, all of those things. Women are passively trying to attract mates over. Typically, again, these are generalizations, but they're based on, you know, our evolution and sexual selection and what we know about those things. But men, the problem with men is that they simply lack motivation. Men's motivation is the correct kind usually. It's usually intrinsic. Yes, I need to lose weight because I feel like crap. But there isn't enough reward in their mind for most of them. They to give up beer and pizza or nachos during the game or something like that is not worth it enough to them in enough of those individual moments in order to just simply bail a beer gut that isn't really negatively affecting their life. When men get out of the shower, even when they're really out of shape, they are far more likely to flex than they are to pick themselves apart. But it's problematic because they're not taking quite the hit that women are with, you know, things like type 2 diabetes and even, you know, heart disease and stuff. All of this stuff is getting really bad in women. Men just can't get motivated enough. They almost need some extrinsic motivation in that, like, if you tell a man, look, your daughters, for example, need to see you taking care of them, taking care of yourself.
Sure.
They need you to be here a long time for them. They need you to be the stable one, especially if mom has been freaking out about her body for a long time. And she says things like, oh, I never talk about my body in front of my daughters. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. They are absolutely going to become what you believe about yourself.
Right.
You need to be the stable one that can show them, look, this is how you treat yourself with love and compassion. And you give a man a little bit of that extrinsic motivation involving somebody that they love, and oftentimes they get great results.
Yeah, that's funny how you bring that up, because I had mentioned in my email to you how, you know, I just have the science and I have the knowledge to change my body composition pretty easily through some work. But I was talking to my wife, I was all upset, and she said, what's wrong? And I said, well, you know, between Thanksgiving and Christmas, it was just out of pure gluttony. I just enjoyed the many baked goods that my mother-in-law and my mother had brought. And I have a metabolism that is very, very low carbohydrate. I don't respond well to it at all through any sort of, I even have to limit my vegetable intake. And it's all because of martial arts, wrestling, cutting weight, gaining weight, cutting weight. So I have to tone it down a lot. And if I let it go, I mean, it comes on, I want to say within 2 weeks, I could easily put on 20 pounds. And so, Wow. And so I was, and I could tell by the way my jeans were fitting. I was like, you gotta be kidding me. And I don't own a scale. I don't get on one. And I don't even like to put my patients on them at work, but I have one at work. So I stood on it. I looked down, I saw that I had put on 16 pounds. And I was like, gosh, you know, that's a lot of work I got to put into taking this off again. And my wife said, you're fine. Why are you even worried about that? You don't look like you put on 16 pounds. And my answer to her, and this is the first time I really thought about it until you just mentioned it, is I have two kids and I'm 40 years old. I don't want to die. You know, it's not, yeah. I could give a shit what I look like at the pool. I don't want to drop dead, and I know what can happen. I mean, I know the damage that complex carbohydrates and when you mix saturated fats with sugars. I mean, I know all that damage, and I know that, you know, that's what's going on. So yeah, that's the first time I ever actually put the two and two together. So do you know what? You went into body beliefs, but I'm actually glad you did, because I learned quite a bit from just this podcast alone. And like I said, I ordered a half a dozen of your books, so.
I really appreciate that.
No problem. And now I'm glad I did, because your passion and your expertise in the subject is amazing. It's something that
you
convey very, very clearly and in a message that I think people will respond to.
Well, that book has I appreciate you buying the hard copies, but I also, to let your listeners know, I give away digital copies and audio copies totally for free on my website, because I'm so passionate about the message. And that's despite the fact that it has a 5-star rating on Amazon for the hard copies with over 70, I don't know, like 73, 76, whatever reviews. And it's still holding a 5.0 on rating. So it's been very well accepted. But I give those copies away because I'm that passionate about this message, especially when it comes to fixing women who influence the next generation. That's a very serious soft spot for me, where I would love to help more young women get through to adulthood without all of this angst. But I've also come to the conclusion that it's going to be very, very difficult to reach them directly. What has to happen by example, because they are surrounded by young men who are testosterone ridden, and the messages that they're getting are not what real life is going to look like later. They don't understand that there's a difference between their own sexuality and male sexuality. They don't, the level of competition is ridiculous. All of this has to come down from mom. And so reaching women who influence younger women is just a serious passion of mine, and I hope to constantly try to figure out ways to get to more of them. But your listeners can go to altshiftdiet.com and just join my email list, and they will get Body Beliefs, the PDF, and an audio version of the book, where I read the book. So, but again, anybody wants to go buy hard copies, I very much appreciate that too.
Yeah, well, fantastic. Well, Jason Sieb, altshiftdiet.com. Thank you very much for sharing your time. It's folks like you that take their time and reach out and talk to us. It actually makes this really weird, bizarre world of information sharing through podcasts a thing. And I am very, very grateful for your time.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. If you ever want me back, just let me know.
All right. I might reach out to you with questions here and there from you know, working on a county. I have 1,200 patients, probably closer to 2,000 patients, and 3/4 of them can use this advice. And I'm starting 2018. I mean, I am hitting, what's that phrase people say? I'm hitting it running or whatever.
Hit the ground running.
Yeah. I mean, I have got, I've been there for 5 years, and I have to make a change. Meaning I put this on myself. You know, people don't have, if you're raising 3 kids and you have a minimum wage job, and you might have 2 jobs, you don't have the time to address these issues. A lot of people don't. They don't have the time to read through these books. So it falls on me, and I feel responsible. And the biggest thing, and I told this to my wife the other day, we were dropping some stuff off to Salvation Army, and it was right before Christmas, and this woman was walking across the parking lot, probably 50 years old, hobbled, could barely make it across the parking lot. And I looked at her, and I said, that is what I want to fix. I could care less if I make a beauty model. I could care less. I want people to, and same thing, I don't care less if I let people live to be 100. I want people to be able to move and to be able to live and enjoy life. And it's not, you know, it falls on me, and it falls on every medical professional that has time in front of people to do. And we have to do something, because we're getting sicker, and it's just not getting better. And we have to break the paradigm, and we have to start addressing these issues.
Right. Yeah, I agree. I feel like we're trying to empty out the ocean by bailing it out with, you know, using our thimbles.
Yeah, but I can feel that way.
But every single person we reach and help to, you know, at least just change their perspective.
Sure.
So that then whatever decision they make is actually based in fact. You know, I mean, I don't have an opinion about whether or not you want to eat nothing but pizza and beer. You know, this is your life, and you get to live it however you want. I'm a hammer when you need a nail driven. Mm-hmm. And I just want you to know what the nails are and then how to use the hammers. And if you don't want to drive any nails, fine.
Yeah.
That's totally fine. This is your body and your life. But the world is full of people with the wrong information.
Mm-hmm.
And that's ridiculous and frustrating and maddening, frankly. Mm-hmm. And, people like you and me are going to keep trying to fight the good fight. So I appreciate the opportunity to do that with you here.
Well, thank you very much, Jason, and have a happy new year.
You bet. Take care.
Like us on facebook.com/WWIPodcast and at WWIPodcast on Twitter. Drop us a line at waitswhatifpodcast@yahoo.com. Listen to us on iTunes, Stitcher, or TuneIn Internet Radio. Enjoyed your listening experience. Now go forth and expand your reality.